selectquote.com. We shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your price can vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervey's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervey. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kasem. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervey and Kerry Kasem.
Good afternoon. I am Alan Gervey, and I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here at Gervey's Law to be the managing partner of your life. Now, Kerry Kasem, my co-host, is on assignment today, so she's not here, unfortunately, because I know she wanted to be here for this show. Her father, of course, the legendary Casey Kasem, spent his life in radio and television, although not a journalist, but certainly cognizant of First Amendment rights. And today, we are going to talk about the media and President-elect Donald Trump's apparent disdain for the media. What is important here is to look at the First Amendment, look at the rights to preserve the First Amendment, and we are fortunate later in the show, we are having on the show probably the most well-known First Amendment attorney of our time, Floyd Abrams, who will join us from New York to talk about what he suggested to a number of journalists, which was perhaps they should sue Donald Trump for his comments. Perhaps there's libel there. We are going to find out all about that later in the show from Floyd Abrams. But first, we want to welcome to the show someone who is well known to everyone who's ever watched the news. And of course, she's the chief international correspondent for CNN and host of CNN's International's nightly interview program, Amanpour. She is the recipient of so many journalism rewards and awards. So we are so honored now to talk to Christiane Amanpour. Welcome from London. Welcome to Gervey's Law, Christiane.
Alan, it's good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Now, I want to congratulate you first because not too long ago, about 10 days ago, you were awarded the Committee to Protect Journalists Burton Benjamin Memorial Award for Extraordinary and Sustained Achievement in the Cause of Press Freedom at the 2016 International Press Freedom Awards. Congratulations on that. Well-deserved honor.
Well, listen, thank you very much. I mean, it is an amazing honor. And it's funny, I sort of have developed this sort of big sister kind of role whereby I really do go out and get really angry and mobilize as much as I can and use any amount of leverage that I have when I see fellow journalists around the world being basically abused by their governments. And that is a very important thing for me.
Interesting you say that, Christiane, because indeed you gave a powerhouse speech at the presentation. And for those of you who haven't seen it, it's available on the internet. You need to Google it because Christiane hit on some really important points and she expressed real concern about what Donald Trump has said in the media and how it will impact the ability for the media to do their job as journalists. Now, let me ask you this, Christiane. There was a lot of impressive rhetoric that you provided in that speech. Do you truly believe, though, that Donald Trump has that kind of power to have such a profound impact on the media?
Oh, golly, yes, I do. Look, whether it's Donald Trump or whoever it is seeking the highest office in the land, ergo the world, the United States is the only superpower left, and what the President of the United States does has massive impact around the world and, of course, at home. You know, I'm British. I came to the United States, went to university, studied journalism, got my job, and worked up in an American company, CNN.
Christiane, by the way, let me just say, you studied journalism. I don't think you know this, but we were at WBRU at the same time.
Oh.
back in Providence.
Well, I was a sports
reporter when you were at WBRU. In fact, I lived in Phi Psi fraternity, John Kennedy Jr.'s fraternity, and you were, of course, living with him down the street outside of Brown University.
That's exactly right. Myself, John, and a few others, we shared a house.
Right.
It was a great student life. It was really fantastic. University was great. I was at the University of Rhode Island, and like you, I interned at WBRU.
That's right.
And that sort of started me on my job. But just to say that as a foreigner coming to America, I was incredibly proud, honored, and empowered because of the First Amendment. That is an unusual privilege that gives Americans the right of free speech, journalists the right to practice journalism freely and safely. So all I was saying is that very unprecedentedly and unusually, we had been pretty much alarmed by the really what I would call the hate rhetoric and the incitement against the press by Donald Trump during the campaign, where he would single out by name certain press people in the
right.
press pen, and where he would call everybody despicable and the most dishonest people he'd ever met. And I actually was shocked. I mean, I was sitting here in London and working around the world and listening to this stuff, and it actually shocked me. But I thought and I hoped that once the election was over and that he won and was president-elect, that things would be different, that the rhetoric of a campaign is different than the rhetoric of elected office and government. But you know, what worried me before I made this speech, which was last Tuesday before Thanksgiving,
right.
was the fact that his very first tweet was basically saying that there were paid protesters around the United States against his election and, quote, incited by the media. I was very upset about that. First of all, as we know, the idea of paid protesters is rubbish, and it has been admitted as a total lie and a fake story by the fake news writer who wrote it. And he couldn't believe, he said, that people actually believed it, and important people in the Trump administration, or rather the Trump campaign, retweeted it. And even recently, a senator tweeted, why isn't the media paying more attention to those paid protesters? Well, because they're not paid protesters, it was a fake story. But the most worrying thing for me was to hear the next president of the United States talk about these people, fictional people, but nonetheless, incited by the media. And, of course, I'm abroad, living in an environment where I go to Turkey and Egypt and Russia and Iran and all these other places where, yes, they have no proper free press rights, no First Amendment, no guarantee to their safety. And many, many times they are, these journalists, accused of incitement, accused of sympathizing, accused of actually being terrorists and subversives. And their political attacks, these are, against journalists. And they end up on trial, and as I said in my speech, in cages, in kangaroo courts. You've seen it in Moscow. You've seen it in Cairo. So I was just incredibly worried, and I needed to, put down a marker that we do expect to, as journalists, be able to report truthfully, honestly, safely, and freely.
And, of course, that is where you should be in your thought. But you have to be realistic and understand that there are people in this country who believe the media is biased. And when Trump says things like that, he plays into their hands. So when you defend the media, do you think that you risk actually inciting those people and playing into the hands of Trump?
No, look, I'll say two things. One, it's true. The media is distrusted. Unfortunately, we have a trust level that is at historic lows. I mean, hovers somewhere either just below or just above Congress. I mean, it's not good. You're absolutely right. And that is because there are a lot of political, partisan, and dishonest journalists who play a political game or who play the tabloid game or who admit to being in the fake news game right now, as we've seen at least one writer give an interview in which he absolutely out and out admits it. But it's true. A lot of journalists or those who are masquerading as journalists have sort of brought a certain amount of disrepute and distrust onto themselves. But I would say that has been empowered and enabled in an incredibly partisan environment where journalists in America are increasingly being pushed into political corners and being forced to take a political side and pushed into these tribal you know, divisions. And that, I think, adds to this feeling of hatred against journalists, because one side thinks they are, you know, hopeless, horrible, hateful people. Another side thinks another lot of journalists are hopeless, horrible, hatred people. And that's a really big, big problem.
You know, Christiane,
I'm talking about journalists who, you know, work for the established newspapers, the established television networks, people who have built their credibility over decades and decades and decades.
Absolutely.
And
I want to ask you.
Honest people who do a hard day's work, and we don't need to be politicized and put into partisan tribes.
And that makes a lot of sense. However, when you look back on your career and you talk about WBRU and the beginnings in Providence, Rhode Island, journalism was very different back then. You didn't have this, as you said, fake media. How are you to combat this fake media? Because the average person doesn't realize that there's a difference between journalism and what the social media can put out there.
Well, look, you know, Alan, I like to think people are super smart. You know, I've never looked down at my audience. I've never treated them in any other way than with respect and dignity, and give them as much information, which is real power in today's world, honest information about what's going on in the world, so that they can make, you know, sensible decisions for themselves, their families, their security, their well-being, etc. And I've devoted my career and, frankly, put my life on the line, along with many of my colleagues, to go around the world being their eyes and ears, and to bring back the most objective, the most truthful, the most honest, the most rigorous news that I possibly can from around the world. And I have always, and as I grow older and more experienced, I'm much more, you know, willing and able to really sort of, you know, again, put my own self on the line to report without fear nor favor. I don't report in return for access. Access is not my first priority. Getting to the truth is my first priority. And I think that what's happened is that there's a whole sort of weird conversion going on here, a weird sort of, you know, coincidence and confluence of outside events. One, yes, the rise of social media, on which people, either named or unnamed or anonymous, are equal partisans and, or equal citizen, and can be, you know, sort of citizen journalists, whereas they are not, by and large. Many people just go out there, as you know, and use the social media for their own personal intentions. So that's one thing. So that is not journalism. I'm sorry, it is just not journalism.
But people don't always recognize the distinction
right,
that you're making.
Right, but that's why this moment is so important.
Now, you said
we now have an opportunity to raise the stakes and to say to people, look, all along you have been, you know, thinking that you're being guided towards truth by various social media engines, by, you know, whatever platform you're on. And you know what? We've just discovered that, A, there is an industry called the fake news industry, which, a.k.a. the lying industry. These are lies. These are not just sort of little, you know, perversions of the truth. These are out-and-out lies fabricated from whole cloth. And it's incredibly dangerous. You also have, you know, the situation where, again, as I said, partisan political journalists are hewing their own political line for their own party. And I think that's a real shame, and I'm sorry about it. I reject it myself. I'm not a political journalist. I'm not an ideologue. I've always, you know, tried to be the objective journalist. And then you have to say, what is objectivity? Objectivity is not neutrality. It's not false balance. It's not creating a false equivalence. Objectivity is going after the truth. So the way I say it to people is, listen, we inhabit a fact-based world. Let's just stick to the facts, stick to the empirical evidence, and make our decisions based on that.
Christiane,
you know, because the rest is feelings, the rest is commentary, the rest is opinion, the rest can be lies, conspiracy theories, and et cetera.
You know, we have to take a quick break, but after the break, I want to ask you something, because you make some good points, but it begs the question, how is the media supposed to be objective now with what Donald Trump has said and put out there? When he calls you a liar, not you specifically, but the media and maybe CNN, how are you supposed to be objective with the president-elect? You're listening to Gervie's Law. We'll be right back.
Oh. there's no place like Norm's for the holidays. Get a $10 bonus card when you purchase $50 in Norm's gift cards, or a $5 bonus card with $30 in gift cards. It's a gift for them and our gift to you. And be sure to dig into our signature T-bone steak, 3/4 of a pound of thick, juicy beef perfection, cooked to order, starting from just $12.99. Served with soup, salad, choice of potato, and a vegetable. For Yuletide cheer and unbeatable flavor, make your holiday T-bone plan. It's the Norm. Normsrestaurants.com. Open 24/7.
You go to the dentist and find out you need a root canal or a periodontist, and that means another appointment with another doctor at another location, maybe in a couple of days or weeks. Well, now there's a much easier and affordable way. Dr. Messer Kani has put together a team of experts at LA Dentists Group, a collaborative dentistry practice, the newest field of dentistry, that provides a prosthodontist, periodontist, orthodontist, general cosmetic and sedation dentist, medical doctor, and anesthesiologist all under one roof. For anxious patients, they do safe sedation. They do implants, full mouth restoration, teeth straightening, smile makeovers with porcelain veneers and crowns, all under one roof. LA Dentist Group utilizes a 3D imaging scanner, so they can save you time by pre-planning treatments. They even have their own lab to personally supervise your final restoration. To schedule your appointment with Dr. Messer Kani and LA Dentist Group, call LA 888-95-TEETH. 888-95-TEETH or ladentistgroup.com.
It's Peter Tilden. If you're having a problem with thinning hair, you're losing your hair, or a flaky scalp, call Regenix. They've been around for over 25 years, helping hundreds of thousands of people get fuller, thicker hair and save their hair from leaving, like Matthew McConaughey. And look at his head of hair. So give them a call. They're located in the Cedars-Sinai Medical Office Towers, so you know they're not fooling around. They'll examine your hair and scalp on a microscopic level, tell you exactly what your problem is, and then how to fix it. The phone number, 800-REGENIX. That's 800-REGENIX, or call 310-358-8888 or go to Regenix.com for better hair.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, we are back and we are trying to do the right thing. Today we're talking about the media and Donald Trump, and we are fortunate to have with us an expert in that area, at least with the media, Christiane Amanpour, who is the chief international correspondent for CNN. She's the host of CNN's International's nightly interview program, Amanpour. Of course, she has been a featured reporter on 60 Minutes, some amazing interviews that she's done throughout the years, been with ABC News and everyone else, just been everywhere. And we're really happy that you're giving us, Christiane, this objective, if I can say that, at least from you, perspective. You've just won this award, and this speech, if you haven't heard her speech, go online, watch Christiane Amanpour, because she doesn't hold anything back. Before the break, I teased the issue of how a journalist can now be objective, or at least cover Donald Trump after he has said these things that mostly have not been very complimentary with the media. Jim Rutenberg of New York Times said, if you believe Donald Trump is a demagogue playing to the nation's worst racist and nationalistic tendencies, how can you cover him? What is your response, Christiane?
Oh, I actually disagree. I mean, I think Jim Rutenberg raises a question, but how can you cover him is easy. Look, Marty Baron, the incredibly wonderful executive editor-in-chief of the Washington Post and formerly of the Boston Globe, where he exposed, you remember, the Catholic Church
right.
sexual pedophile scandal. He comes to the Washington Post, which is the era of Watergate and all the rest of it. He just wrote an incredibly important sort of, you know, call to arms about how to practice journalism going forward. And he made a lot of good points and good suggestions. But above all, he said, we continue doing what we do. We just ply our trade. It's not just Donald Trump. It is the whole post-truth era. It's not just one person. It is a situation that we find ourselves in for better and for worse. And I would say for worse, that this post-truth phenomenon has gathered such a huge sort of, you know, tailwind,
right.
And it is plowing into our realities. And so I guess I would say the following. First, we as journalists, we mustn't, you know, confuse what the truth is. We mustn't confuse balance with truth. We mustn't confuse neutrality with truth. We mustn't confuse objectivity with neutrality or balance. We have to understand that there are empirical, objective facts in our world, and those are the facts that we have to, you know, keep reporting on. And if somebody, anybody is going to out and out distort them or lie about them or fabricate or, you know, peddle conspiracy theories or whatever it is, then you call it out. You do it in a respectful, dignified, and professional manner. I don't think it's difficult. Where the difficulty is are enough journalists and organizations willing to do that, to do their basic job? And I think that's a question that far predates this election campaign. I think for a long, long time, journalists have been, certainly in America, certainly covering whatever the institutions of power, have been way more concerned about access than about digging down to the bottom. Obviously, there are many people who are great investigative journalists and who do that job fantastically. But as a whole, I would say, you know, in our media world, in our social media world, where everything is about a like and a share and a this and a that, you know, sometimes people don't want to go or fear to take that extra mile to find the truth. Well, now we are confronted with being forced to do that. Now it's really, really important.
Now,
because the Oxford English Dictionary just chose, you know, post-truth
right,
as their word of 2016. So I think we can do it. We have to be brave enough to do it. And we have to call out, for instance, you know, people like Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, and we have to say, you need to police your platform. You need to do your bit to help us. We have to call out the advertisers. You need not to be giving money to lies and fake news and other fabrications. So there are many ways we can do this.
Yeah, see, the problem, though, with Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook is they can always say that they have their First Amendment rights. People can say what they want. You know, we're going to have Floyd Abrams on in a minute, and he ended up actually writing an amicus curiae brief for Mitch McConnell. He's not a right-wing Republican, but he did it because he believed on the Citizens United case about the First Amendment. And if you want to hold on to your beliefs of the First Amendment, then it seems somewhat hypocritical to say that we have to kind of dictate how the journalists should behave. In terms of advertising, of course you understand that it's a business. Slimy advertisers just want to make money. They don't care so much about these, you know, highfalutin objectives that you're talking about. So
yes, well, look, I mean, listen, Alan, yes, you're talking absolutely, you know, right in terms of the theory of matter, but you're right. Do advertisers want to be associated with out-and-out lies and what's now being portrayed around the world as a very negative product? Do they? That's my question to them. I very much doubt it, and I very much expect that when they realize that they're being made fun of by the writers, by the way, who say, yeah, we're lying, and we tell the advertisers,
right,
nonetheless, they still advertise on our platform, hopefully shame and responsibility will work. We belong to a community. We belong to a civil society. We're not out there in a shark tank. This isn't, you know, sort of a pre-human civilization we're talking about. If we want to have a functioning community, then we have to abide by certain standards. I'm sure you were told when you were a kid, like I was told, you don't lie and get away with it. There are punishments for lies. There are consequences for lies. And I don't think the First Amendment protects willful lying. I mean, it, you know, of course it protects free speech, but I think that, you know, you also have to be an adult and you have to realize that when it becomes, you know, indistinguishable from the truth, and not only that, when it is used by a foreign power, by the way,
right,
and ask all your viewers to go and check out all the reporting that's been done out of Russia. It is their national strategy to destabilize our democracies in a manner of ways. It's called war by another means, and they have an ideologue called Gerasimov, who's a longtime, you know, high-level member of the, you know, the Russian apparatus, who has talked about using information to, you know, continue the struggle in another way, obviously without all-out war. But, you know, information is power, and when you use information, you know, in a malevolent way,
it is powerful. It could be
so
considered.
I just think people should be aware.
You know, you're right. It could be considered information warfare. But when we look at truth with a capital T, or post-truth with a capital P and T, or fact checks with a capital F and C, meaning that's really the truth, not just what we read about. We can't differentiate. Fact checks have become almost a fallacy now because people don't
have
know
they?
What to believe.
I'm not sure that's true.
Well,
I'm not sure that's true. I think you're painting a way too dark a picture. If there are enough people willing and able to stand up about what they actually know are lies, then you'd have a different situation. Look, of course you're not going to legislate people to stop lying. Of course you're not going to quote-unquote censor. But what you are going to do is hope that what you can do is actually find people whose job... I mean, come on, journalists have a moral and a fiduciary and a professional duty to tell the truth. And please don't tell me that truth is relative. It is not. Facts are not relative.
That's right.
Facts
and that's why we're talking about a capital, not just the small t, and that's what we've come to now. It doesn't make any sense how people can't distinguish, like you said, what is the truth from what is fallacy. And that's, you know, a battle that you fight. Your passion is really important for journalism because so many journalists or quasi-journalists or pseudo-journalists don't have the passion. They're just trying to get reactions. And they're coming from a perspective. When you talk about objectivity, a lot of people think that there's a left-wing bias. It's a national phenomenon in the media. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, look, you know, people, as I said, journalists have been forced increasingly into partisan corners and into the tribal morass of what politics has become in the United States and in many other parts of the world. I think always, there have always been more sort of liberal journalists and more conservative journalists. It has always been thus in the U.S. and all around the world. But presumably, journalists, whether they're liberal or conservative, can figure out what objective news is. That's always been the case. And the opinion, you know what I mean, the sort of opinion stuff
right.
is usually confined to the editorial pages, which is where it belongs and which is its rightful place. But what's happened is all of that stuff has come into page one, top of the news, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, the opinion and the political views have morphed from where they belong, rightfully and necessarily, and we should see a variety of views, of course. They have gone now into what I would call, you know, the A block and the headline news and all the rest. So they're indistinguishable from news and commentary. But I would say, not to get too depressed, there are thousands and thousands of fantastic American journalists working all over the country, whether, you know, West Coast, East Coast, middle of the country, North, South. Every single year, I have the privilege of judging an award called the Livingston Awards, which is for journalists of 35 years and under. So under, we call it the Pulitzers for the young people. And I am staggered and stunned by the amazing quality of the work that comes out of all of America. It is really, really staggering how good it is. And that is, for me, the hope for the future and for the present, that there are people out there and they all know who they are. They enter their work in our award, and I'm sure many others. But I get to see this every year, and I'm so impressed by the quality of their work and the desire and the commitment to searching for the truth and exposing all sorts of wrongdoings and illuminating all the right doings. The good things that go on in the world. So I we are in a moment. I say we don't despair. We don't throw our toys out of the pram. We don't throw our hands up in the air and say, oh, my God, this is so bad. It's all lies and we're never going to be able to get out of it. No, we're just going to be sensible and we're going to hope that our readers, our listeners, our viewers, whoever goes online can actually maybe put a little bit of extra effort in these days and fact check and double fact check. In other words, you know, double check everything
right.
that they see from areas or platforms that they're not fully familiar with. There are plenty of platforms, CNN and all the other legitimate news organizations who trade in truth and objective news. So, you know, it's out there. And people just have to be careful of what they're buying into.
You know, I think that's right.
I will say, though, Alan, you are right. There is a small segment of the population that may be growing that willfully wants to stay in its own bubble and in its own echo chamber and doesn't want to believe whatever counters their opinions. You're right. That does exist.
But the important point that you've made is that there is a distinction between partisan editorial commentary and journalism. And in this new day and age, I think younger generations aren't realizing that, and they need to. And when you give that message that you have to look at real journalists versus people who may have an agenda. Now, people may argue with me and say every journalist has an agenda or every media outlet has an agenda. Well, that may be true, but at the same time, when you talk about double fact-checking and triple fact-checking and getting to the real, what I say as a lawyer, evidence in the matter, that's what we have to encourage people to do. And I appreciate the fact that you have talked about turning a negative into a positive, because it isn't all negative. There's something that can be learned from this. In a minute, we're going to let you go because I know you have to do your show. But Floyd Abrams is going to come on, and he's going to talk about whether the media should actually sue Donald Trump for what he said. I don't know that that's the right way to go. What do you think?
You know, that's not the way I'm going to go. I'm just going to be very hopeful that he doesn't open up libel laws that will enable us to be sued with much more, you know, ease and put much more pressure on the press. I hope and I believe that once he's president, he will come to accept that that a great America requires a great and free and strong and independent and rigorous press. I genuinely believe this to be true, that a great press, a great, you know, profession of journalism is a vital underpinning of a strong democracy and a strong civil society.
And you don't think that he's going to ditch the press pool, or he's going to encourage certain people in the press to be eliminated and given a muzzle? You don't think that's going to happen, do you?
I certainly hope not. But, you know, we're here to report, and if things like that, you know, happen, if the worst case happens, you know, we're going to continue doing our professional job and seeking redress and recourse that's due to us under the Constitution of the United States. My view is, if we behave in a less than professional way, that's the biggest risk for us. If we're professional and do our jobs and seek the truth and speak the truth and report and publish and broadcast the truth, then we are on terra firma.
Taking the high road, I think, is the hallmark of journalism. We appreciate your comments. Christiane, thank you so much for being with me today on Gervie's Law. I know you have a show to do. You're in London. You're way ahead of us. We're going to catch up later in the day. Have a great day, and thanks again. We appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You are listening to Gervie's Law. We're going to have Floyd Abrams on when we come back.
I'm Nick Soboleski, a SelectQuote agent with a true story that could save you hundreds of dollars a year. A woman named Linda just called. Her husband, Ray, has a $300,000 group life insurance policy, but is changing jobs and can't take it with him. Well, I impartially shopped the highly rated term life insurance companies we represent and found Ray, who is 41 and takes medication to control his cholesterol, a 10-year, $500,000 policy, for under $26 a month. That's almost twice the coverage for less than half of what he had paid. If SelectQuote hasn't shopped for your life insurance, you're probably paying too much.
For your free quote, call 1-800-329-4100. That's 1-800-329-4100. 1-800-329-4100. Or go to SelectQuote.com. We shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your price can vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855 855-4-RGW-LAW, 855-4-RGW-LAW, or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, you are listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. I am Alan Gervie, and we just had a whirlwind interview with Christiane Amanpour from CNN. Boy, she has a lot of opinions and really provided some objective perspectives, even though some people would say she leans in a certain direction. She talked about journalism versus fake journalism and talked about the truth with a big T, as I like to say, a capital T, and what we're searching for. Ultimately, there was a very positive message in light of all of the negativity that we read about with what Trump has said against the media and what the media said against Trump. Now we're going to change gears a little bit. We're still going to talk about Trump and the media, but we're going to get an expert's perspective. Probably the most well-known First Amendment attorney in our time. Very, very prolific. He has had so many notable cases that I can't even mention them all, but some of them, such as the New York Times and the Pentagon Papers case, Senator Al Franken in a trademark lawsuit brought by Fox News over the use of fair and balanced, and of course in a showcase of principles over politics, representing Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in an amicus curiae brief in the Citizens United case. Floyd Abrams, partner with Cahill, Gordon, and Reindel for almost 50 years. Welcome to Gervie's Law.
Well, thanks very much.
Now, you have been a busy guy over the last few weeks. You are everywhere. There are so many people who want to talk to you about what is going on with the media and the First Amendment. We really appreciate your time today. Let's talk a little bit about what you said. Basically, you said perhaps, you didn't tell anyone to do it, but you said perhaps the media should think about suing Donald Trump over his comments. Is that really realistic, or is that just rhetoric?
Well, I don't think it's rhetoric, but it may not be realistic. The point I was making is that if there were a sustained attack on the press by the new president, and if it were the sort of things which give rise to libel litigation, false statements, defamatory statements, statements made with knowledge that they're not true, I said that I thought the press ought to bear in mind that they have rights too. And one of them is that they could bring a libel case.
But wouldn't that have to be on the state level? Because what President-elect Trump would say would be across the board, of course. Wouldn't we have to really look at the individual state laws?
Sure. The only libel laws we have are state laws. They're quite similar to each other. Indeed, that's one of the things that I think Mr. Trump was unaware of when he had earlier said that one of the first things he wanted to do as president was to loosen up the libel laws. Well, he can't do that for two reasons. One, there is no federal libel law. As you rightly say, libel law is all state law. We have 50 libel laws or 50 libel practices, so to speak, one in each state, governed by state law, not federal law, except that, of course, they have to be consistent with the First Amendment. So what he was saying then, it's just not doable. There is no legislative fix that he could get through unless he went down to the state level. And in any event, anything that he would really want to do, because of what he was talking about, it was making it possible for someone like him,
right,
to bring a libel suit.
But
the First Amendment is a very large protection which stands in his way.
Well,
go on.
You say it stands in his way, but let's reverse this a little bit. I know you didn't vote for him, but you have your principles, and you have been a proponent of the First Amendment for your entire life. Not that a president should use that as its sword, but can't Donald Trump say, hey, I have my First Amendment rights to say whatever, given the fact also, you know, obviously you said that within the libel laws, but maybe he will use that as his sword and you will be the champion.
Could be. I mean, he has.
I thought you were going to say fat chance.
Well, fat chance. Look, even presidents have First Amendment rights. And of course, he would be given a wide, wide berth to have his say. It's very important that presidents speak out, have their say, and the like. What I was positing, and this was a room of journalists, I was positing for them was that they were not helpless. There's been a lot of defeatism for a lot of reasons, some of them sort of political, and I'd say even more journalistic. And I was just letting them know that you know, they're not without weapons of their own, obviously the most important one being public opinion rather than anything involving the courts or lawyers or the like, but that was available too. And I appreciated when I said it that journalists who spent their lives fighting libel and trying to get libel law as narrow and constrained as possible, you know, wouldn't exactly leap to the chase.
Now,
but yeah, go on.
I was going to say, we were speaking to Christiane Amanpour just a few minutes ago, and she said, you know, she would not consider, or any media outlet that she worked for, she doesn't believe would consider suing him. But she did say her biggest concern was what he could do in terms of muzzling the media. And from your perspective, again, we're talking to Floyd Abrams, First Amendment attorney extraordinaire. From your perspective, how would he be able to muzzle the media? Are you talking about, for instance, him pointing out in the room and saying, you're out? How would this all work?
Right. Look, there are different things that he could do. I don't think that there's a genuine risk of him changing the libel law. So that doesn't concern me about him, except on an attitudinal level.
Right.
What could he do? Yes, he could try, he might well try, because he did it in the campaign, to bar certain journalists from attending press conferences, say, at the White House. That would give rise to a First Amendment litigation, and I think he would lose. On the other hand, you know, journalistic organizations these days are not as well healed as they once were. And the idea of having for them to have to sue to get in, you know, is not a very attractive one.
So what would his remedy? Let's turn this around. What is Trump's remedy against the media if there is some outlandish statements or rhetoric that is, you know, beyond objectivity? Right. What is his, you know?
Well, he's done very well, hasn't he?
He has. Using social media.
So he is not without weapons. And the weapon of public opinion, which would rally to his side, you know, would be very considerable. I mean, he's gotten over 60 million votes, and there are a lot of people who would certainly support him in just about anything he said that was critical of the press. And as you point out, he has the world is changing. I mean, social media has led to, you know, more speech, more people, cheaper, more available, and in general, I would say, less constrained by adherence to facts and to anything approaching journalistic standards. But it's there, and he can certainly use it. We have every reason to think he will use it.
Right. And again, you made comments that, and we appreciate them, that you said, hey, you're cheering for him, even though you didn't vote for him, but you're not hoping that he is going to take this country into a downward plunge. But at the same time, you become circumspect when you see certain tweets go out, for instance, when he talks about protests being incited by the media.
Right, right. And see, when he talks about that, I have two sorts of reactions. One, it's not true. The protests were not incited by the media, and the protesters are people who don't have an awful lot of regard in many respects for the, at least the establishment media. Second, that's an area, too, where I'm not worried in terms of anything which will have any sort of legal limitations.
Right.
You know, he can't strip people of citizenship.
For burning a flag, right?
Well,
how does he even say that?
Yeah. Well, that's something that we all have to look to those people who voted for him to answer. How can he say it? He can say it, I think, because he woke up in the morning and he was angry.
Yeah.
I think he meant it. I don't think it was just a political ploy.
But do you think that he knew that it was First Amendment protected?
No, I don't think so. No one's ever lost votes by attacking people who burn flags.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Flag burners are a very tiny, tiny group. They're not even a group of people.
Yeah, and there are probably a lot of people who agreed with him.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure and overwhelming.
They want to send people back.
Yeah,
get them out of
here.
Sure.
But again, the reason I'm not concerned about him being able to do anything about that is twofold. One, you can't take someone's citizenship away for any grounds other than the person has renounced it. I mean, you can't strip a first-degree murderer of citizenship. That's not a penalty that the Constitution allows. And of course, as you pointed out, flag burning has been held to be protected in any event under the First Amendment.
Exactly. Floyd, we have to take a quick break. We got another quick segment after the break. We're talking to Floyd Abrams, First Amendment attorney with Cahill, Gordon, and Rindell. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow, and like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I would flip-flop all night long, I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you could move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep REM sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed, it's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever. You can buy one of my pillows and get one absolutely free.
Go to MyPillow.com or call 800-324-0629 and use promo code KABC. That's 800-324-0629. Or go to MyPillow.com and use the promo code KABC.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervey and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
Yes, and we are back. We were talking to Floyd Abrams, First Amendment attorney, legend, probably the best and most well-known First Amendment attorney of our times. Floyd, before the break, we were talking about Donald Trump and the media. We were talking about the fact that he probably isn't going to be able to change libel laws, and he isn't going to be able to legally muzzle journalists from the law perspective. What about how he might make it difficult for journalists to get information, such as with the Freedom of Information Act or revocation of FCC licenses? How would that go down?
Yeah, look, presidents do have a broad power, administrations do, about the release of information. And if they were to sort of tighten up on the Freedom of Information Act, it would take a lot of litigation over a lot of years to get information out. I'm more concerned by the second example that you cite, and that is the use of administrative agencies of the federal government to pressure the press in one way or another. I mean, one Republican congressman has already urged the Federal Communications Commission to investigate the coverage by broadcasters of the election. And that congressman said, and you know what, if they were unfair, and bearing in mind this is the public airwaves, they should lose their licenses. Well, you know, license revocation is like capital punishment.
Right.
And now it's not that it happens often, and it's not that it can't be fought, but what, if we were to move to that ballpark, if we were to start down the road of the administration cracking down or even threatening to crack down on broadcast licenses, that's a sort of pressure which is very dangerous, you know, because in part it's so easy to comply.
Well,
just you know, toning things down a bit.
We should hope that there are checks and balances in our system that wouldn't make it as easy as people might think.
And absolutely.
And that's what we really need to focus on. Now, Trump recently met with editors and writers of the New York Times. Do you believe that there can be a reset with Trump and the media, or has it gone too far?
I think that it is possible, but I think ultimately unlikely. It's possible because press access means a lot to journalists, and that there are journalists who are willing to pay a serious price to get more access.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's one sort of concern.
And that may just be the hallmark of his presidency.
No, it could be. It could be. The reason I don't think there's likely to be a reset is that I don't think he's going to be working very hard towards doing it. And it would take some work. I don't mean to salve wounded feelings.
Right.
It would do some, because that's not the way he thinks about things.
I agree. I mean, the mentality just isn't there. He's had every opportunity to make good on a lot of issues, and he seems to revert back. So we'll have to wait and see how it turns out. We only have a couple more minutes. I did want to ask you about The Soul of the First Amendment. That's a new book coming out from you in 2017.
Yes, that's being published by Yale University Press in April. That's a book which is sort of about American exceptionalism, how special we are and the degree to which we protect free speech and freedom of press. I mean, for example, we've been talking about President-elect Trump. He said things during this campaign which would be crimes in Canada and in England and in other democratic countries. What he said about Mexicans, what he said about Muslims would violate the law in most of the democratic world. Now, we protect that, and I certainly think that we're right in protecting it.
So this is something that we can look out for in your book. We have to run, but I do want to put a plug in because I'm looking forward to reading it. It's The Soul of the First Amendment. Now, are you doing a debate tonight at the American Jewish Committees?
How do you know all these things?
I know all this stuff. Against General Counsel Mark Stern on the merits of an undocumented person on a college campus.
Yeah. What the debate is about is it's a hypothetical situation where a student at a public college wears a button saying illegal immigrants go home to Mexico.
Wow.
And Latino students protest, and he's told that he couldn't wear the button, and he sues. And I am defending the conservative organization that is supporting his right to wear the button, as I would in real life.
Absolutely. I mean, that is fascinating. I would love to. Hopefully they'll videotape it. We can see it on the internet. Floyd Abrams, I want to thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's good to talk to you.
Good luck in the debate, and thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. And everyone else who's listening, what a great show. Thanks for listening. This is Alan Gervie signing off from Gervie's Law.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.
On average, Angelenos spend an additional 80 hours a year behind the wheel due to traffic. And while we can't help you recoup that time...